from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, we'll update you on the Asiana airline crash, which occurred at San Francisco International Airport over this past weekend, and discuss in depth the ongoing investigation. Then at 9:30, we turn our attention to the ongoing change in government and the chaos and unrest in Egypt following the removal last week by the nation's military of its civilian elected president and former Muslim Brotherhood head, Mohamed Morsi. That's all ahead in this morning's first hour of Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Investigators are trying to determine why a Boeing 777 crash-landed at SFO Airport on Saturday, killing two passengers and injuring more than 181 others. Witnesses said the Asiana Airlines flight came in low and fast and that its tail appeared to hit the runway. The blackened airplane was engulfed in flames and much of its roof had been torn off. And this is the first fatal accident involving a Boeing 77, that is 777. The airline said it did not appear to be a mechanical problem, but also declined to blame the pilot or the San Francisco control tower. And we're going to discuss the crash in this first half hour, what it means for commercial airline safety, and talk about it with a number of experts. Joining us first is Rachel Miro, host and reporter for the California Report. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
Well, we're just really beginning to piece this together, but we know a lot more than we did when the crash occurred. And I just wanted to find out from you, first of all, what we learned, particularly from the press conference that was given by Deborah Herzman. I wanted to actually have you hear a cut from this because she's talking here, and we should mention she's the head of the National Transportation Safety Board. This briefing, she said the plane was traveling at below the target landing speed.
The speed was significantly below 137 knots, and we're not talking about a few knots.
So that's significant, isn't it?
It is. 137 knots is the target speed where you want to be as you hit the tarmac. And, of course, you want to hit the tarmac and not the seawall just between it and the sea. Which is what happened on Saturday. This pilot was not going fast enough when it touched down, and it touched down on the rear end, which of course broke the tail off that impact, and things went horrible from there.
When you look at what happened, in fact, it's amazing that as many people got out as did. Although there are a lot of injuries now, there's spinal cord, abdomen, in addition to Chinese schoolgirls who were killed. One of them may have been actually killed by the rescue operation.
That's something the San Mateo coroner's office is trying to determine. There's an autopsy being conducted today, and the hope is we'll learn whether she was killed by the impact, the roll of the plane, or whether there was a fire truck that rolled over her, as the coroner's office is putting it, a secondary incident. We don't know yet.
Also learning that this pilot, well, this was his maiden voyage, and he'd only had 43 hours with this particular Boeing jet.
Well, it's important to say it was his maiden voyage landing
to San Francisco.
San Francisco. Right. He had nearly 10,000 hours flying other planes. He was just fairly fresh with only 43 hours with the 777.
Which is significant also, although at this point, South Korea is coming in to do an investigation. We still haven't come to any conclusions. It's looking like pilot error, though.
Well, you know, a lot of people are coming to that conclusion. There might have been multiple factors at play. We don't exactly know what was working, what wasn't working. There were no indications, if you listen to the communication with the control tower, that anything was wrong until the very end. And at that press conference you mentioned, where the chairwoman of the NTSB board, Deborah Herzman, was talking, she carried us through the last 7 seconds. 7 seconds before impact, a crew member calls for increased speed. That's the first indication the control tower would have had that Something was really wrong. 4 seconds before an alarm goes off, it's called a stick shaker. Basically, the pilot's yoke is telling him, you know, that a stall is approaching because they're not moving fast enough. And then less than 2 seconds before the crash, a call out from a crew member to go around the airport. And Herzman said at the press conference yesterday, the big question I think everybody wants to know, what was going on between those two crew members? Who was in control of the plane?
I thought the crew was supposed to be attempting to abort the landing, weren't they?
That was the indication, and apparently it seems, you know, from video, as far as we can tell so far, that they were simply trying to abort the landing far too close to impact. There wasn't enough time for the plane to thrust off and take another go around the airport.
There is a video on our website, by the way, kqed.org, of actually an eyewitness seeing this, and I wonder to go to a pilot who we have to bring into this discussion, and that's Daniel Rose. He's a partner at Kreindler & Kreindler, which is an aviation law firm, and also a military-trained pilot, aviation attorney who's handled a number of cases involving Boeing equipment, for example, the Turkish Air and Southwest crashes. And Daniel Rose is with us from New York City. Good to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, at this point, there are a lot more questions, perhaps, than there are answers. But the CEO of Asiana Airlines pretty much ruled out mechanical error. Can we really rule out mechanical error at this point?
It's probably a safe bet, given even the preliminary information that we know on. I would be careful to caution that mechanical error is not the same as, for instance, design error. I mean, you could have systems working as designed on the plane that still may have caused or contributed to the end result.
And there could be all kinds of things that we're going to learn about, presumably from the black boxes and from all of the tracing of what happened. I mean, you can just pretty much simulate exactly, almost to a T, what occurred, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there'll be no question, I don't think, between the black boxes, the CVRs, the flight data recorder, the availability of the flight crew and other witnesses to really know exactly what happened here. This isn't going to be an Air France 447 type issue where we didn't even have the record for years afterwards.
Well, I mentioned this video that's now on our website, and there are some who have been, throwing some serious charges at the media, particularly because of, the perspective that this is the first crash in about 20,000 airline flights that have gone over nearly 12 years. And when you look back, say, at 1985, when there were 27 crashes throughout the world, maybe is this being played up too much? Is it kind of media coverage that's sensational?
I don't think so, and obviously, certainly for the loved ones had people that were injured or killed on the flight or had to experience it, you don't want to be that one. But the reality is, certainly, aviation safety, especially in this country, has improved drastically over the decades, and there's good reason for that. There's a lot of good procedures and policies in place, both at the manufacturer level, the airline level, and air traffic control, and what that establishes and proves is that it can be done safely. And, you know, there's really no reason with the way the system is built, with redundancies built into it, with a proper training for any crash to happen. And that really should be the standard. And it's, within the country, we're pretty close to being in reach of that standard. You know, once you start going outside of the U.S., it becomes a little bit of a different situation. Europe is still obviously very comparable to us in terms of safety, but some of the third world countries and some of the Asian carriers are at a different level in terms of aviation system safety. Although they try to emulate, and in fact we help them in a lot of respects, They still haven't gotten there, and to some extent.
Let me rectify something I said earlier. Apparently, in my introduction, I misspoke, and I said that the plane was low and fast. It was actually low and slow. Talking now with Daniel Rose, who's with us from New York, from Kreindler & Kreindler, an aviation law firm. Actually, Korean aviation standards, which took a beating back in the 80s and the 90s, there's been a major turnaround there, hasn't there?
Yeah, I think so. That's certainly what the track record has borne out up till this point. You know, you rightly point out to some of the crashes in the 80s. In fact, Korean Airlines crash in Guam, one of the cases are firm handled. One of the things that really came out of that was the emphasis on crew coordination and the concern about, you know, the hierarchical nature of the relationships in the cockpit. And, you know, to some extent, whether that's, you know, culturally impacted. And you know, in other words, is there a hesitancy or a resistance on, say, the first officer or the co-pilot or the backup pilot to speak up or challenge or correct what the captain or the more senior, the older person in the cockpit is doing? And that's exactly contrary to the fundamental concept of crew resource management, which is to have cross checks and make sure that the second person there, the second pilot there, is checking the first pilot and vice versa.
And what about the autopilot?
Well, in terms of the autopilot is another resource, certainly, that the crew should be able to use it, but it's just another tool. It's another resource that has to be managed properly, and it's not, you know, we're not at this stage, and, you know, maybe we will at some point be where you hit a button and the plane goes from A to B, and you don't need a pilot in the loop. We still have that, and you still need it, and the autopilot is just another tool that has to be monitored, and it's part of being a competent pilot, and it's also part of the human factors issue of, you know, how does the flight crew interact with the autopilot or the automated systems on board the plane? I think that's an issue here too, potentially, which is, you know, is the automation doing what the flight crew expects it to do?
Well, there's also a device that helps guide pilots, and it was apparently out at SFO. But, you know, I'd like to just get your take. Again, we're talking to Daniel Rose, who is with Crinler & Crinler. He's a military-trained pilot and aviation attorney. And get your take just on the sense of the runways here. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the closeness of the runways here and the danger of the airport, but it's too easy kind of to blame San Francisco and San Francisco Airport, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. In particularly in aviation accidents, they're classically the result of a chain of events. And, you know, some may be more prominent than others. You could have piloting error being a prominent cause, but you could have other causes like the instrument landing system being out, which is, you know, often relied upon as a backup. You could have fatigue from a trans-Pacific flight. You could have perhaps bad handling by air traffic control that put the plane in a difficult situation to land safely. You could have the traffic from the parallel runways being a distraction. So, you know, all these little things, any of which, you know, in and of itself wouldn't have necessarily caused the crash, but in combination did, and had any of them been eliminated, you wouldn't have the crash. And that's part of what accident investigation in this country is all about, is not just finding. It's easy to say the pilot should have done this and should have done that, and this is just pilot error, but you really, you know, in the interest of aviation safety, need to dig a little deeper and find out what are some of the other, you know, contributing factors beneath that may have allowed the inevitable result, and if they weren't present, would have prevented this crash from happening.
And we should mention that the NTSB investigation will be in accordance with the Convention of International Civil Aviation, the Montreal Convention. There are pretty strict airline liability guidelines for passengers and for aviation disasters in terms of family assistance. I want to offer those of you listening an opportunity to join our conversation here with any questions or comments you might have. This is a half-hour segment, so if you have something you'd like to add to the conversation or contribute, the time to call would be now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us toll-free now at 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email number is forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And a number of other ways, of course, to communicate with us. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or you can go to our Facebook page. But again, if you'd like to join us now by phone, it's 866-733-6786. And I'd like to bring Bill Waldock into this conversation. He's professor of safety science with the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. They're an aircraft accidental investigation crash survivability group, and he's a retired Coast Guard officer, and he's in Prescott, Arizona. Good morning, Bill Waldock.
Good morning.
Glad to have you with us on Forum. And let me just begin by actually a question that's been lingering in my mind, particularly since we have this video for our listeners to go to on our website of an eyewitness. Just, it's my understanding that early speculations on crashes often all really turn out to be wrong, and there was certainly a lot of speculation early on with this one. But also, you get an army of eyewitnesses or passengers on board, and they're not necessarily reliable.
Well, that's correct. Typically, witnesses to an event are the least reliable of our evidence package because the human perception systems are so changeable and so variable that it's difficult sometimes to get really good information out of them.
And what about also the dangers with people grabbing their carry-ons and going down that slide? There's a sense that not only was that perilous for other passengers, but actually could have resulted in even more tragedy.
Well, you end up with blockages, and you know that's one of the first things typically that flight attendants are taught is to make sure nobody brings anything with them, and obviously that doesn't work very well. In this case, they really didn't have any time at all to prepare. The airplane crashed, and the flight attendants are having to react. And plus, I'm hearing a couple of the slides apparently inflated inside the cabin. That explains that left forward slide that was deflated. I was curious about that right from the beginning because it didn't look like the fire got at it, but it turned out they had to deflate it with an axe.
Well, there's a great deal for us to learn about this, but at this point, would you say that it almost seems to be pointing more toward the likelihood of pilot error? I mean, on Sunday we were talking about all kinds of wind shear and fuel line freezing up and turbulence, all sorts of, again, speculations. But at this point, would you say it's fairly safe likelihood that pilot error was involved, seriously?
Well, now that the NTSB has released some of the preliminary information that they got from the flight recorders, it doesn't appear anything at all was wrong with the airplane. And the weather was very benign that morning. And when you start ruling out everything else, you're usually left with the pilots. So that's probably where most of the investigation begins to focus.
And again, we're talking now with Bill Waldock, professor of safety science with the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Let me bring our callers into this, and we go first to you, Gary. Good morning.
It's Bill.
I'm sorry, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, Michael. Good morning. Just wanted to make a quick clarification point that I think could be confusing to some people who don't understand the technology. When the reports have come out that part of the technology for the landing system at San Francisco Airport was out, there are two important points. One is it's been out since the beginning of June, and all pilots would know it. And number two, there's a backup system called a PAPI that's in place that the pilots would have used. So to place any emphasis on the landing system being out at SFO, I think, is a red herring.
Okay, agree, Daniel Rose, red herring?
It's close to a red herring, I would say. I think again, as I said, in the interest of really exploring fully what happened here and what were the contributing factors, I don't think you can just discount it out of hand. I agree that, you know, a pilot should be able to land without the use of the glide slope on a visual day like today and with the PAPI systems. But, you know, they still can be a contributing issue. And, you know, there's a reason why commercial operators require pilots to use an available glide slope even on visual days like today. And that's because it's a good backup system. And the caller's right, though, Bill, I think it was you know, there are other ways to do it. The PAPI is a lighting system on the side of the runway. You know, the glide slope provides you information a lot further out that can help you get into a stabilized approach earlier. But certainly once you get in close, you can see the lights that he was referring to. And there are even other systems on the plane. So, I wouldn't call it a red herring, but it's pretty close.
Let me bring another caller. George, join us. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm surprised that no one has remarked yet on the fact that this level of detail released by the NTSB this early in the investigation, in my experience, and I'm also a military and airline trained pilot, is unprecedented. And the woman was speaking almost with disgust in her voice when she said that this was more than just a few knots. This isn't a smoking gun, it's a guy holding a smoking gun. I think that's the elephant in the room, and I'm surprised that no one mentioned it.
Now, let me ask you, Rachel Morrow, I mean, it was pretty early to come in from the NTSB and Deborah Herzman. Right?
It is interesting to point out, and, you know, this is less than 48 hours after the incident. They had lots of people combing the scene, but, you know, the weather was clear. Lots of other pilots, as we've heard, have managed to make this landing, even with the instrument landing system down for maintenance.
And we know enough about this jet to know it's state-of-the-art technology.
I mean, there are a lot of interesting questions that are going to come out of this crash that might help to improve the 777, improve seats, improve seat belts, improve luggage handling. It is remarkable that we're seeing from federal officials what appears to be a quick zeroing in on what they think is happening.
You mentioned the seat belts, and that's particularly true in light of some of these injuries. I mean, there's spinal cord injuries and abdominal injuries that seem to be possibly related to seat belts.
Well, you know, the first thing to bear in mind is that plane was tossing about, so
yeah.
Many of these seatbelts may have saved people's lives, but then on the flip side, we are talking about tremendous G-forces pulling on people.
And let me thank the caller.
You've got two sets of G-forces happening there.
It's Bill Waldock. Go ahead.
Strike. Yeah, this is Bill. Sorry. You got two sets of forces happening. When they struck the tail on the seawall, you got one set of forces that very obviously crushed the tail structures and actually took the tail off and exposed the aft pressure bulkhead. Then the airplane slammed forward, and it's that impact with the front part of the airplane that probably generated most of those vertical Gs that gave the spinal injuries they're talking about.
Now, Bill, let me go to you again on an email from a listener, Rick, who says, I'm a private pilot, never flown a jet, but I'd like to know how long it would take a 777 to develop any significant power from the approach power profile, which I understand was at idle. I know that jet engines need time to spin up, and 7 seconds seems way too late to recover.
He initiated the go-around 7 seconds later he hits the seawall. Typically, engines take anywhere from about 7 to 10 seconds to go from flight idle to takeoff power. So he was just about starting to get enough power when he hit the seawall.
And Daniel Rose, another listener, Mark says, where's the left engine? The debris field includes the tail and landing gear, but no engine.
I think that it was located. It was located off, actually, to the right side of the runway. I seem to recall seeing a photograph that's
specifically identified. Yeah, it looks like it's about 300 yards away or so.
Yeah.
And we're coming up on the end here. Can anybody talk about getting a number of emails asking about the video cameras? In fact, Johnny says, doesn't SFO have cameras that record all the activity of aircraft on the tarmac and as they take off and land? It would be sad if vital forensic evidence is lost because the airport has cameras recording baggage handling and the security gates, but not the skies near the runway.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of those questions from my friends over the weekends. They can't believe that, you know, you have cameras in delis and grocery stores, but you don't have it at an airport. And, you know, when I was in the Navy on the carrier, that's exactly what we did, is filmed every landing. Of course, you know, the margins were a lot tighter there, and there were, you know, more frequent issues with the approach because it's just so particular to make. I guess that's part of the reason is that, you know, we talked about this earlier, the overall accident rate is limited in the U.S., and certainly if you pare it down to landing accidents, it's even less. And, you know, we're talking in an area where we're fighting over, you know, sequestration issues to ask Congress to put out money for video cameras at every runway at every airport, I think.
Yeah, we got seconds left. Rachel, where does the investigation go from here?
Well, we're waiting to hear later today. We're expecting a press conference around 11:30 a.m. local time.
And we will cover it. Rachel Morrow, thank you. Thank you, Bill Waldock and Daniel Rose. When we return, Egypt.